From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The images from the Philippines are harrowing. Thousands dead, life just flattened by a massive typhoon, survivors desperate for food and water, and all the world's help having trouble getting in. Relief is the urgent challenge. And then the big question, what fate for Pacific islands and coastal communities all over the world in this century of rising seas? This hour on Point, responding to and reading Typhoon Haiyan and the devastation in the Philippines. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you have family there, friends in the relief effort? What are you hearing? What do you see in this devastation? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Margina Fernandez lost her home and her business in the storm on Sunday in Tacloban. She told CNN the Philippines is desperate.
Get international help to come here now, not tomorrow, now. This is really, really like bad, worse than hell. Worse than hell.
And that was Sunday. The typhoon was Friday. Now we're well into the next week and there is suffering. Joining me now from Cebu City in the struggling central Philippines is Ivan Watson, senior international correspondent for CNN. Ivan, thank you very much for being with us. What's the latest on the death toll? Will we ever fully know the death toll, Ivan?
Well, the official figures are that some 2,275 people have been confirmed as victims slain by this storm and its aftermath. But we're still getting eyewitness accounts of bodies lying out in the open in the largest population center to have been hit by the super typhoon. That's the city of Tacloban. So we could probably anticipate for that tragic number to continue growing.
2,000 plus confirmed dead now. How bad is this situation post-typhoon, Ivan? Is it possible, given the hunger, the thirst, the disease we hear is beginning to appear, that we could have as big a death toll after the typhoon as in it?
It's very difficult for me to judge that. I think one of the biggest challenges has been simply information and communication. I was very struck working overnight from Tuesday to Wednesday night here throughout the night at the airbase nearby here, which has been a sort of logistical hub for the typhoon-stricken area. I was struck to have met a number of young volunteers from Eastern Samar. That's an island that was also struck, that was parts of it were the first place for the storm to make landfall. And these young men and women had collected their own food donations that they were hoping to send to their hometowns, many of them from Giwan, which was, again, one of the first towns to be hit by the typhoon. And these young men and women, most of them had not had any communication with their families in their hometowns after 5 days after the typhoon. If you can imagine the fear and uncertainty they were feeling, and the fact that they were basically doing what they thought they could do best, which was just try to at least send some food over to that area. One of those young men, in the last 8 hours I spoke with him, thankfully had finally gotten a phone call from his father. Some kind of telecommunications had been restored for his father to call in and say, yes, you know, we're still alive.
We've got U.S. Military trying to help bring in aid, and they have begun to do that by the ton. We've got U.S. Marine Brigadier General Paul Kennedy right here on the ground in Tacloban on Monday saying entire communities were wiped away.
Every building is either just significantly damaged or destroyed. You know, it's a 15 to 25 foot wave came across entire villages, and so everything's wiped out.
Ivan Watson, there in the central Philippines, Cebu City, how does the flow of relief aid at this point compare with the need?
I still think it's a process that's just starting to pick up. I mean, as of Tuesday, the Philippines Air Force could not fly into the main airport in that town of Tacloban after dark. The operations were limited between dawn and dusk. I'm looking at now the Philippines Armed Forces says that lights have been installed there and they'll be able to work 24 hours. So that is definitely an improvement. We know that ships are starting to move into the area. I think the more isolated communities, the smaller population centers, have bigger problems because the roads, we're hearing, are still difficult to maneuver due to the debris on the roads. They don't have the benefit of having an airstrip or an airport there where some of the aid is being focused. So that's the big challenge here, is how to get out into these islands. This is an island nation, and that makes travel and transport more difficult. You have to travel by sea, you have to travel by air in many cases to navigate to get from one island to another. And those are the links that were particularly damaged by this storm.
Ivan, I've spent a lot of time in the Philippines. You no doubt have as well. I've seen a lot of typhoons there. Are Filipinos saying this is a typhoon unlike others that they have seen?
Absolutely. You know, I flew into Tacloban, the city of more than 200,000 inhabitants, on Sunday, a small plane accompanied by the director of basically the Philippines equivalent of the FAA, who was trying to figure out how to reopen airports. And when we were looking from the sky, and then when we landed and he saw the damage, this guy was a former commander of the Philippines Air Force. He said to me, "I'm 70 years old. I've never seen anything like this before." And that's been a mantra that's been repeated by every Filipino I've met, not only in the areas in the east that were hit by the storm surge, this wall of ocean water that seems to have been biggest cause of death and destruction in the east, but also further to the west in islands that I visited that weren't nearly damaged as much, but were hurt by high winds that ripped off roofs. Everybody across the board said they'd never seen a storm anything like this before.
And let me ask you about how it's being interpreted. You know, the Philippines' diplomatic representative, Ivan, in Warsaw, Poland, at the big climate talks going on there right now, has gone on hunger strike. He said he's going to not eat until the world does something about climate change, which he has linked to Typhoon Haiyan. Is that being linked to this typhoon? Maybe people are just too hungry and thirsty to think about it. But in Manila, in Cebu City, where they have a moment to think, are they linking this to climate change? Ivan Watson, are you there, my friend? We're going to have to leave that question hanging right there. We will address it in this hour. Here's the sound of one survivor among the many who gathered at the gates of the airport in Tacloban looking for aid, been sleeping on the street, talking here with the BBC's John Donison.
No, we're so very hungry and thirsty. That's why we're here, because if you have water or food there, maybe you can give us.
Give us just a little, maybe. UN Humanitarian Chief Valerie Amos talked with reporters in that same city on Wednesday. Yesterday, say she understands the relief is too slow for those in need.
I've seen all of those pictures. I've heard the complaints from people. I absolutely agree with them. You can't have people who are here, who are desperate, who can't get anything to eat and don't have water.
We're going to look at the whole picture on the ground and the big global picture as well, especially across the Pacific in this hour. Joining me first today in the studio is Michael Delaney, Director of Humanitarian Assistance at Oxfam America. He's led Oxfam America's response to emergencies for the past 13 years, has been coordinating relief efforts for Oxfam in the Philippines. Michael, thank you very much for being with us.
Great to be here.
You've seen a lot of disasters in your time. What about the scale of this one and the challenge in relief?
Yeah, I think the big issue here is the way that this typhoon has utter destruction through the islands and the logistics difficulty of working in a country that has over 7,000 islands.
Of course, here it came in from the east, traveling west, hits this east-central part of the Philippines, and we've all seen the images now of everything flattened, the airport, the tower down for a long time, coming in just kind of tag-team style. What about port facilities there? Do they have facilities to bring in, you know, cargo ship-scale relief?
Yeah, we're hearing this morning that all the airports now are opening, and the ports are getting a bit better. Communications is starting to be restored in terms of cell phone and cell phone communication. Electricity is still down, and that is impacting the water, which we're very concerned about as Oxfam.
Do you have staff on the ground on Leyte Island in Tacloban?
Yes, we have three different teams now being deployed. We have materials that have just gotten in today into Tacloban. And we have also materials in Cebu, which we are beginning to distribute, water, sanitation materials to help. We're very concerned about the second wave right now. This is, you know, the survivors deserve aid. They have the right to aid. And we are trying to prevent a second wave of deaths.
This has to be a real race against time now, given the scale of this. How many are without food, clean water, at health risk?
Absolutely. We're thinking of particularly around the issue of water, the idea that electricity is being down, so pumps are down, filtration systems are down, and people are using water that has been in open wells and contaminated, actually. And so we're very concerned about that as a water source.
Contaminated by human refuse at this point, but also by these very high seas. They've
exactly.
got salt water in their fresh water.
That's exactly right. So we're getting the filtration systems in, getting chlorine systems working, getting tanks to distribute water are part of the race against time right now.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about Typhoon Haiyan and the Philippines, devastation and relief efforts there, and the growing vulnerability of island nations at a time of rising seas. You can join the conversation this hour. How are you responding to these images, this desperate need in the devastation after Super Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines? Do you have friends, family there, working in relief there? What are you hearing? And can you believe the extent of the damage? How much is just flattened? Will the survivors now suffer and die after the storm? I guess the bigger question is this our future? More of this, superstorm, super typhoons, how will we cope if it is? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Here from the BBC today, talking with BBC's Razia Iqbal, is Dr. Christine Atiyuviaro. She's talking about devastation in her hometown of Cebu when she went to make sure that her family was safe, what she has seen.
My hometown was like a wasteland. It's like a garbage dump. I can't even describe. It was horrible. It was like a no man's land. Trees without leaves. Trees uprooted from the ground. Dead people on the street. Flattened houses. And, you know, just people aimlessly walking around searching for food and water. That's, I couldn't forget, you know, that sight. It will haunt me. And the stench of decaying bodies. It probably would haunt me forever.
Will haunt her forever, and maybe the world. We'll talk in a moment with MIT's Carrie Emanuel, who's looking at climate issues, how they may and may not be involved in what's going on in the Philippines. Michael Delaney is with us. He's Director of Humanitarian Assistance, Oxfam America. He's been coordinating relief here in the central Philippines. And Michael, as you point out, not only is this Pacific island in an area where seas are rising, but this is a particularly poor part of a poor country.
Yes, in this particular area of the Philippines, over 40% of the population are living below the poverty line. So people are dependent on fishing, dependent on agriculture, and all of those assets have just been wiped out. So we not only know that we've got a race against time, but this is going to be a long-haul response.
What about the reports we're hearing? I mean, people say, you know, crowds around food distribution points, crowds disrupting food convoys on the highway when they're even managing to move with all the trees that are down there. Some call it looting. There's some kind of even gang action here, but also just desperate people. Are your people on the ground worried about organizing relief in the middle of this kind of suffering mayhem?
Absolutely. This is something that we contend with on a regular basis in our relief operations around the world. This is day six, and people without water, without food, can and will do desperate things. So precaution in terms of how we operate and in moving from center to center is vital. And what we want to we have this exact same goal as the survivors right now in getting people what they need for their immediate survival.
We've had reports coming in just early today of Philippine security forces exchanging fire with armed men amid widespread looting around shops and warehouses for food, water, and other supplies. That just coming into us from Reuters. What about the safety of relief workers, your own included?
Yeah, we've had our people have seen organized and unorganized looting from some people going from town to town and taking supplies in some of the unaffected towns, actually taking some of the materials and food and other materials from that town and bringing it back to their own.
I mean, presumably people who normally wouldn't
exactly,
do that
right.
Might do it in this circumstance, on top of which we've heard Tacloban emptied its prisons in advance of this so people didn't just die in their cells. I mean, it's hard to say who's doing it now.
That's right. And not to mention that there is an armed insurgency in the Philippines as well. And there has actually been some conflict between that insurgency and the military.
Could any government handle what we're seeing here? What about the Philippines' readiness? It's an island nation, 7,000, huge population, 90 million and fast-growing population. Here, we're in a part where they don't have even big enough runways for big planes to get in. They're facing who knows how many decades of this kind of threat. Now, of course, there's always been a historic typhoon threat here. What about readiness for calamity?
Well, I think we have to remember that this has been this one of the strongest storms that has ever hit a country. The sustained winds between 150 and 190 miles an hour, this has been a challenge for any country.
And I'm looking here at a map of Typhoon Haiyan at its height, the eye of the storm and the great sort of spiraling circle around it. This is superimposed on a map of the United States. It nearly blots out the entire continental United States. This was huge.
Yeah. And I think that we, you know, have to remember the Philippines, you know, has been facing, as you mentioned earlier, a number of typhoons in the past years. They've actually done a lot of preparedness. They have worked in their mainstreaming their risk reduction and their climate change adaptation in their ministries. This just has overwhelmed them as overwhelmed the government of the Philippines as that map outlines. You know,
I mean, it makes preparation almost seem like a tragic joke here. Well, who can prepare for flattened cities?
Well, certainly the logistical struggle right now is enormous, and it goes beyond a single government, and that's why we have the international community responding as it is to help support both the national and the local governments in the Philippines.
Let's hear from our listeners who are very focused on what we're seeing here. Jack in Cleveland, Ohio. Jack, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I was curious to know if, like, the Russians and the Chinese and the South Koreans have pitched in to help these people with the storm, because that, like you said, the second wave could be horrendous. And Russia and China are two huge, powerful nations that have plenty of resources to help.
Sure, and China very nearby, though with some geopolitical tensions with the Philippines. What do you know about this, Michael? We've heard about Saudi aid coming in. Of course, we've seen the American aid much talked up here, British aid coming in through Dubai. What about Russia? What about China right next door?
I don't know about China. I did hear that the Russians did support with a medical brigade going into the country. But I don't know about the situation with the Chinese government at
this
point.
That would be very interesting to watch if the Philippines would accept that aid, if China will offer it. And, of course, there's the geopolitical kind of dance. Who's got the big influence here, the United States or China in the Pacific? Of course, the Philippines, a former American colony with very long ties to the United States. And American planes going in. We heard this morning an American general saying, we've got 50 tons, I think he said, in already, and they're going to start doing something like, I think he said, 100 tons a day. How does that, let's just say that stream, match up with the need when you get hundreds of thousands of people, maybe millions, in need?
Yeah, I think what is happening now is that we have the aid starting, the aid pipeline starting to arrive. The biggest challenge is going to be, and what our teams on the ground have seen, the challenge is getting out of the major cities where the airports are and getting to the rural areas. There are some areas still to day six that we don't know what the situation is in, like in those towns. And so, you know, I think the aid pipeline going into the country is lining up, but that logistical difficulty of getting it from the major cities is going to be the biggest challenge right now.
And the whole world watching, as so many live just at kind of not just their wit's end, but maybe the end of physical capacity to survive as the days tick by. Day six now since this typhoon hit. Michael Delaney, stand by. Our listeners in Omaha, Nebraska, Patrick is calling. Patrick, you're on.
Yeah. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I don't want to take away from the what you're doing. I mean, you're talking about terribly important things about the sixth day and the disaster after the disaster, et cetera. But I just, don't you think that, I mean, your vulnerability to climate change is directly proportional to how much coastline you have. And so your island nations, if you look around the world, that's where the consciousness of climate change is greatest, starting with the islands that are being inundated, but also, you know, just Iceland, Japan, et cetera. So your island nations are the vanguard of the experience of climate change.
Yeah, consciousness, to say the very least here. Hold that thought. I mean, Michael Delaney, you know it's true. We're going to these people, if the sea rises, they live on the sea. And it's interesting that it rises more. It's rising more in some parts of the world than in others, which is not easy intuitively to understand. But we're going to look at that. Patrick, let us hold that thought. We've got a caller coming in from the region here, south of the Philippines. Peter is calling from Indonesia, from Bali in Indonesia. Talk about an island in the sea. Peter, thank you very much for calling from Bali. What do you know?
Well, yes, Indonesia has 6,000 islands, but we don't get hurricanes. I just wondered, they say they don't have water and they're in the pouring rain. This doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, yes, some days it's been raining, some days it hasn't. I appreciate your call. Be safe there in Bali, Peter. Thank you for your call. I mean, Michael, we did see the rainstorm came. People had tarps out trying to collect it. But I guess when you're talking hundreds of thousands, millions of people, it's just hard to get a continuous stream and people's needs are great.
Yes, certainly people are practical. People are, you know, will become, you know, they will take action on their own and they will, you know, invent ways to catch that water. But the issue is sustaining that. And don't forget that rain came in as a tropical storm. And so the winds associated with that and just trying to capture all of that water is very difficult. In fact, we were on the other side of the city. Our teams were on the other side of the city in Tacloban just getting to the airport yesterday in the midst of that rain, in the midst of new flooding, took over 3 hours to just get across this small city. So the rain can be a blessing if you have the right equipment to capture it, but it's also hurting the relief effort as well.
Hard to put a dainty bucket out in a typhoon or even just a windy rainstorm. One more call. We'll go to Carrie Emanuel. Holly in Iowa City, Iowa. Holly, you're on the air.
Thank you. This is just the introduction to the effects of climate change. 97% of climate scientists agree without a doubt that humans are causing climate change. Humans cause this mess. Humans can clean it up. The first step we need to do is divest from carbon emissions. That's coal, petroleum, fracking, gas, and invest in solar, wind that are a good team, in renewable energy that does not emit carbons and other pollutants that do cause warming, and ship renewable energy tools to the Philippines immediately, because that will help relieve the distress immediately. Humans die within days without water.
Holly, we've got it. You're ready to change the whole big energy picture, ready to connect a lot of dots here. We're going to look at that in just a moment. I appreciate your call. We're looking at the aftermath of Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines. It is fierce, and we're looking at the relief efforts and the bigger picture right here. Let me bring into our conversation from New Harbor, Maine, Kerry Emanuel, professor of atmospheric science at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He has studied the frequency of high-intensity storms in the Pacific. Kerry Emanuel, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for being here today.
Hi, Tom. This certainly is a terrible tragedy.
Everybody's trying to put it in some larger context, and it's interesting because we just had this big IPCC meeting just this in the last few months that I think said that we cannot yet see the influence of climate change in some of these superstorms. What connections can we make? What connections can we not make, Kerry?
Well, excellent question. I want to preface it by saying that in the Pacific region, we have the problem in detecting any influences on typhoons that we're not really measuring them very well. Up through 1987, the U.S. Navy flew reconnaissance aircraft into typhoons, and we got good readings on wind and pressure and so forth.
Ironically, this is when we had a naval base in the Philippines that was kicked out. I guess once we left, we stopped.
We stopped. It wasn't. I don't think it was that particular closing of the base that led to that, but about the same time we stopped doing mm-hmm. that. And so we have to kind of guesstimate hurricane intensities from satellites, and they're very good at detecting storms, but they're not very good at measuring winds. So we'll never know how intense Haiyan was. And most of us believe that it's probably in the top 10 of tropical cyclones on the planet, in the record book. And many of us think it's the top 5, but I don't think we'll ever know for sure.
And what about a correlation or not between this storm and climate change? Many people are really concerned about that.
Well, they should be. We can't, of course, make any kind of attribution of any single event to climate change. But what we do believe from theory and models is that as the climate warms, the incidence of very high-intensity events like Haiyan should go up. Just about everybody agrees on that. That's also in the IPCC report. We also are worried about two other aspects of tropical cyclones. They should rain a lot more. And although rain wasn't a big issue in this storm, if we think back to 1998 with Hurricane Mitch, Central America, 12,000 dead, that was all from freshwater flooding from rain. And rain goes up very quickly with temperature and storms. And the third aspect that we're worried about is the diameter of storms. There's some new research that suggests that might also go up. And that really has a big influence on things like the storm surge, which is a kind of tsunami, except that it occurs in the middle of a hurricane. It's driven by winds rather than an earthquake. But it's basically the same phenomenon. And that's a big killer. It was in this event. And when you have a bigger storm and you have an elevated sea level from global warming, it just makes it a lot worse.
Do we have that elevated sea level already? And is it worse in this part of the planet? And if so, why? We always think of water as settling to a, you know, equal level all over the place.
Yeah, well, this is one of the interesting things about sea level rise. Most people assume it's uniform. It isn't. And there are lots of reasons why it isn't. But the principal one is that one of the big influences on local sea level is wind. Wind circulation patterns can pile up water in certain places and depress it in others. So in this particular part of the world, we think that the sea level has gone up about 8 inches or so, which is fairly substantial. As the climate continues to warm, the water expands, and that will cause sea level to go up further. Also, as land ice melts, principally in Greenland and Antarctica, that contributes more to sea level rise.
And so this part of the world, the Western Pacific, how does sea level rise look here around the Philippines?
Well, as you go along global warming, the sort of fractional changes become a little bit more globally uniform. So the best estimates from the IPCC is we could see another couple of feet of sea level rise in that part of the world by the end of the century.
Of course, I mean, we had water 13 feet, 4 meters high coming in here. So it's still just a margin of what's moving.
Well, that's right. But, you know, a foot or inch counts in the storm surge. It may make the difference between whether you overtop a levee or a wall or not, as we saw in Hurricane Sandy closer to home.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Typhoon Haiyan and the Philippines. devastation and relief efforts there, and the growing vulnerability of island nations, coastal communities at a time of rising seas. Michael Delaney is with us, Director of Humanitarian Assistance at Oxfam America. They have 100 staffers working in the Philippines right now on this, alongside many others trying to get relief. And as we hit day six after a super typhoon that has left so many in the midst of devastation, without food, without clean water, facing increasingly health risks there as well. And we're looking at the atmospheric issues here as well with Carrie Emanuel, professor of atmospheric science at MIT. He has studied the frequency of high-intensity storms in the Pacific. What can we do? Well, leader of the Philippines diplomatic team that's in Warsaw, Poland, as the storm has hit, as the devastation has unfolded, negotiations going on a successor global treaty to the Kyoto Treaty, which was only so-so as far as success in implementing changes goes. Yeb Sano is the head of the delegation there. He spoke up very movingly as the storm hit before the gathered delegates in Warsaw, saying he was going on hunger strike until something was done.
By failing to meet the objective of the convention, we may have ratified our own doom. We cannot solve climate change when we seek to spew more emissions. In solidarity with my countrymen who are struggling to find food back home, I will now commence a voluntary fasting for the climate.
That fast could last a long time. I mean, we're hearing reports out of Warsaw here looking at the Alden Meyer with the Union of Concerned Scientists saying never have the stakes been higher with expectations so low. Carrie Emanuel, you look at climatic issues that take decades, even centuries to resolve. What about humans looking at this? You know, Kyoto didn't work out so well. People, the United States never ultimately signed on. Now we're looking at something new in 2020. What about the sort of what's already in gear here in terms of climate change and what humans might do to rein this back in? Or is this beyond our impact now?
Well, you know, Tom, the tragedy of global warming is that it's principally caused by the developed countries because they're the big consumers of energy. But as we've just seen, often the victims of it, the first victims of it, are in developing parts of the world, places like the Philippines, Africa, all these low-lying islands. They're the ones that are really getting hit hard. And every successive tragedy like this is inevitably going to build a lot of pressure, as we're already seeing in the talks in Poland, from the developing world to get the developed world to do something about this. And I don't know whether this will ever result in a solution, but I think that's where the pressure is going to come from.
I mean, you say they're the ones paying the price, but tell that to the people in the way of Superstorm Sandy in the United States last year, even in the heart of our biggest city.
Well, that's right, and I think that's a very good point to raise. Not very long before that, we had Katrina. You know, if Haiyan had come in, plowed into the southeastern U.S., does anybody really think that the situation, our response, the number of deaths, the destruction would be appreciably less than we're seeing in the Philippines? Our history of dealing with these events is not very good. As a matter of fact, the Philippines is quite good at dealing with ordinary typhoons. They get hammered quite a few times every year. This one was so off scale that nobody could have coped with it.
You've looked at Pacific island storms, trying to project out into the future what may be coming. When the Philippines has 7,000, there are much smaller island clusters there in Micronesia, the Marshall Islands, you know, Kiribati, Palau. What about these Pacific islands, sort of storied islands in human understanding of where we live and our history? Our vision of the planet is shaped in part by these swaying palm trees, these beautiful islands. What does their fate look like in this century, Carrie?
Not good at all. I mean, a lot of these islands are very low-lying, like Kiribati. I think the highest point in Kiribati is a meter. The people who live there fully expect, and not unreasonably, that by the end of the century their islands are going to be pretty much underwater. But the first really bad experiences they will have, and as we've seen in the Philippines, are from extreme events, bad storms and things that are just made so much worse by the sea level being higher. So the prospects for those folks are not good at all.
Michael Delaney, are your staffers around the world seeing the impact of this? On Pacific Islands, another just low-lying mainland communities, but look at Bangladesh with so much low-lying. And, of course, everyone points to this. Our human population has grown so much that people are pushed right into flood zones that they might not have even tried to live in before, but they're there in huge numbers now. Are your staffers seeing this? And what about the issue of climate justice that Kerry raises?
Yeah, that's a great point. I think in some ways, just to put this in perspective, the land mass of the Philippines is only about 3% of that of the United States, yet it has twice the coastal area of the United States.
Divided into 7,000 islands, that's a lot of coastal exposure.
And so they are, yeah, I think the word exposed is highly exposed and vulnerable. And yes, we are seeing more of these types of events, and we are looking at the idea of governments to help prepare and respond more. But at the same time, I think this idea around the justice issue is important, because as we ask them to do more, as we ask local governments to do more and local organizations to do more, one, who is going to support that and pay for that? And it gets back to the idea around reducing global emissions. And why we are preparing for more emergencies as Oxfam, we're also out there advocating to reduce global emissions.
I mean, you have now coalitions of these island nations. They've put together legal experts to figure out whether a drowned nation technically still exists. If it's underwater, does it exist? If its population has to move, where will it go? Who pays for that move? Lots of issues come up here. Some of these issues on the table right now in Warsaw, Poland. Let's go to our listeners. Jacob in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Jacob, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question, I'm a nursing student who is wanting to work a significant amount of time in health and medical humanitarian organizations.
Yeah, great.
I would like to ask is, since a lot of people, you know, feel really motivated to help out in situations like this, and lots of help is unneeded. Lots of help is needed, but lots of help is unneeded, and lots of people can help in ways that are actually not great. I was wondering if there are any suggestions for people who really want to help, either themselves going or wanting to donate in goods or money, ways to be effective.
Jacob, it sounds like you're ready to get on a plane, on a boat, and ship out. We do have a list of organizations at our website, onpointradio.org, where you can contribute. But, Michael, this is right in your wheelhouse. What can people most effectively do to respond here?
Yeah, we as international organizations are working closely with each other. So, and we have people and expertise on the ground. We have connections with local governments. We have connections with local organizations. And so better than collecting goods and trying to send them off through shipments and air flights, it's best to support those types of organizations that have an experience and have capacity on the ground. Otherwise, we risk clogging up ports and clogging up airports with goods that are hard to unpack, and people don't really know what it is. So
don't send teddy bears.
Yeah.
Send maybe cash to you and others who can put it efficiently to work on the ground. There are links to Oxfam and more at onpointradio.org.
Absolutely. Thank you. And I think that, you know, as we are you know, yesterday I was in a coordination call with other organizations, CARE and World Vision. All have good, programs on the ground and are working. So there's a coordination process. We're trying to spread out, not duplicate roles, and do the best we can at this time.
Let's go to Jay in New Orleans, Louisiana. Jay, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing? I'd like to address the water shortage situation, and I'm wondering if reverse osmosis units are being implemented. When I was in the Coast Guard on this tiny island past Midway, we used to suck the seawater out, run it through a reverse osmosis unit, and we had tanks and tanks and tanks of water to drink.
Yeah, so reverse osmosis. I mean, Saudi Arabia does this on a giant scale. Of course, they've got all the oil to power that up, and right now the power grid is down in much of this part of the world. Even generators that were there swamped by the high water and out of commission. What about water here? If you've got wells that are now, you know, so close to sea level that they're salted, and you've got the power out so you can't pump it in, Is bringing in fancy equipment, doing reverse osmosis, an option for a need on this scale, Michael?
Some of the military equipment is doing exactly that, and they're coming in and with their ships and are able to do that even off of the ships. What we do is we look for water sources. It could be even polluted water sources. We can filter that out and then get clean water. So we and then get it transported to where it's necessary. So we basically go in looking for any type of source, and sometimes we can repair existing water sources. Other times we have to begin from new and with a water source and begin the filtration process.
It's an imposing challenge when so many are in need, and the old water system, which we hear wasn't great in the first place, is right out of commission. Brooks in Montgomery, Alabama. You're on the air, Brooks. Thanks for calling. Hi.
Hey, I'm a former Marine. I was a former gate guard at the former Subic Bay Naval Base. And I was there when Mount Pinatubo erupted.
Yeah, so in the heart of the Philippines on Luzon, so to the northwest of here, yes.
Yeah, and I stayed there for 2 years and got to experience the rebuilding and the cleanup. And it's traumatic to see the impact that this sort of thing has on the poor. And gave me nightmares for a month. Just gave me nightmares.
You are a gate guard, so people presumably at the gate throngs there asking for your help.
Oh, absolutely. And young women, men, were just huddled around us at the gate, just despondent, wouldn't talk. The rumors, the lack of water, it was horrific. From there, they sent me to Somalia, Operation Restore Hope. I got to experience extraordinary need there. As I've gotten older, I look at these things in the news, and I, having been there and providing security for different relief operations in tough parts of the world, I can't help but wonder why such efficiency in delivering that initial need, those initial supplies. It seems to me that the world, the modern world, can absolutely inundate areas of need with supplies within 48 hours.
Yeah, Brooks, we'd like to think so. Let me pick it up right there. It's a great question. Michael, what about it? You must think at Oxfam and other relief agencies, big picture here. I mean, we're hearing from Kerry Emanuel and others. We may see more of this in this century. We may see a lot more. The kind of thing that made our Marine caller, really hurt emotionally at the gate is the kind of thing your people see all the time. How do you look forward into this century? Can we sort of have giant relief just on tap, ready to drop in anywhere at a moment's notice? Or does this inevitably run beyond our capacity? Why?
No, it's an excellent point the caller has made. We actually think right now that with the growing climate events that we're seeing, just like this typhoon, that the humanitarian system is broke. It cannot respond to the many competing needs there are around the world right now, and we have to do something very different. There has to be a step change. And so while we are enhancing our response capacity, we're also training local organizations and even working with local governments so that they can do more ahead of time in terms of programs that reduce the risk, building shelters that can withstand these types of winds. And so our focus is a long-term focus in trying to really change the idea of response with an international response and really looking more towards local organizations, local governments to support, to be the people on the front line, which they are.
What do you expect out of the rest of the world if we see this upward trend? Since time immemorial, humanity, that we know a certain rhythm. Catastrophes come, and there's a rhythm of catastrophe and relief, and then a period of calm, and then something else happens somewhere. If that speeds up, what you must have thought about what the reaction of the world population that contributes to groups like yours is going to be. What are you anticipating?
Yeah, well, that is exactly what we're seeing. You know, the 100-year drought in Ethiopia is now happening. It was happening every 10 years. Now it's happening every 5 years. These types of events, these typhoons, cyclone, hurricanes, we're seeing more frequently and more severe. So what we need to do is shape and educate around what kind of model can we use. And we really believe that it's much more based in,
make it local.
In enabling local and local organizations, local governments and local government and national governments to do more ahead of time and take the lead at the time of the response. Now, the Philippines government has actually started to do more, and they have incorporated programs, but it's a poor country. And so they have just started along this path. And
you don't know where it's going to land, and you can't stockpile huge stockpiles of food, let's say, when you've got people in poverty living day to day all around them. It's going to be a challenge. Kerry Emanuel, what are the odds that we get into this, maybe we're there already, this more high-frequency major catastrophe global life? Is that where we're headed, or is that still an open question, Kerry?
Well, we certainly think in all probability we're headed that way. It will vary, of course, from one region to another. I might mention that this whole, in the case of tropical cyclones, this whole problem is greatly exacerbated by demographics. That if you look around the world, you see not only is the population going up, but people are systematically moving into regions that are at risk. So coastal populations go up. And when we actually look at the economics of this, we see that coastal population growth and increased storminess and risk of storminess contribute roughly equally and in a quite large way to the problem going forward.
Kerry Emanuel at MIT, atmospheric science professor there. Thank you very much for being with us today, Kerry.
You're quite welcome.
Michael Delaney with Oxfam America, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
My Filipino friends asked me to call out to Filipinos, Mak Pakatatag, be strong in the Philippines. Thank you to everybody who's joined us today. Aid groups at our website, onpointradio.org, if you want to help. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.